These are in listen-only mode.
Oh, good evening and welcome to Controversial Research in ME, CFS and Fibromyalgia. It's our series with me, Elaine Wilkins. I'm so delighted to be back with you this evening. Gosh, the time just really, really flies, doesn't it? So maybe I could just start with a little hands up just to see how many of you can see the screen and hear me okay. You should have a little hand icon there if you're new to webinars. So if you can just seek that out for me and click on it, that will just let me know that everything is loud and clear. If you can't make your little hand work, then you've also got the question box there, which you can type anything in as we go through. And please do feel free to use that question box this evening for any questions that you have as we go through. Super excited about what we have lined up for you tonight. And we've had so many emails in about what we covered last night and what's coming up. So it's really created such a stir. And this is webinar two tonight, so we're going to be taking things in a slightly different direction. So just thank you so much for joining us. It's really delightful to have so many people so interested in helping people with ME, chronic fatigue and fibromyalgia. So let's just remind ourselves of what tonight is. Webinar two is GET, which is graded exercise therapy, really the answer? And it's understanding the pathophysiology of pain and weakness in ME with my wonderful guest tonight, Margaret Papoutsis. And I'm gonna be sharing a bit more about Margaret later, and you'll see exactly why we invited her to come along this evening to share her wisdom and expertise. So is the sound okay? Just if I could just see hands up if the sound's okay. Somebody just said it was a little bit faint. No, okay, sometimes you get that with a little bit of a dropout sometimes with the sound. So hopefully we're okay and good to go. So in webinar two, in today's session, I'm going to be covering the predispositions and the ME profile. It's something that hasn't been taken into account in the current research that we are reviewing during these three webinars, and something that's absolutely crucial part of what we do at the Chrysalis Effect. So as I mentioned, our guest expert this evening is Margaret Papoutsis. She is has expertise in many areas, and specifically osteopathy and nutritional therapy. So we'll explain a little bit more about Margaret. Her content tonight is starting with, sometimes the show doesn't go on, so all will be revealed about that in a little while. She's also going to be clarifying for us exactly what graded exercise therapy is and why it seems to be such an important part of the NHS referrals. As I said last night, for those of you that were with me, it is one of those things that is a bit of a postcode lottery, what you're offered really when you are diagnosed with one of these conditions. So she's also going to go through understanding decreased energy production and the causes. The impact of decreased musculoskeletal repair capacity. She's certainly testing out my verbal dexterity this evening, and also considerations when prescribing exercise or body work, linking into the six phases of recovery. Six phases of recovery is something that we find an absolutely essential roadmap for helping people through their recovery process. One of the most difficult things when you are diagnosed, and those of you that are new on this evening, I actually suffered myself for 6 years and was literally offered very, very little help. And it is very much for many people a case of seeking out your own answers, which is often why if you are a practitioner, you'll find that people are practitioner hop and go from one person to another, to another, to another. So they do find it extremely enlightening and such a relief to see that there are specific phases of recovery so they can know what to expect. And it gives them a real route map to work towards, so they understand what's in each phase and how to get there. And also we're going to be looking at what's coming up tomorrow in our third and final webinar tomorrow evening. So just a brief recap for those of you maybe that it's your first time in this week, maybe you were seeing clients last night. We had Ruth Townsley with us last night, a nutritional therapist, and Ruth took us through in fantastic detail about mitochondrial failure. She explained the relapse and remission cycle, which clients really do need to understand. She also explained her own fatigue journey and gives us such a fantastic understanding of why, you know, how clients feel. She went through adrenal fatigue. She looked at a case study, she looked at hypothyroidism and how all this is linked into fatigue. She looked also at the HPA axis, and I think we're, you know, that is a commonality really with all of the three webinars that keeps coming up, and also gastrointestinal tract disturbances as well. So that's just a little recap of what Ruth covered last night, and many of you will know that we're looking at is the work of Professor Michael Sharp. He seems to have headed up this PACE trial that was originally done in 2011, and there's the reference there, the Lancet volume 377, for those of you that are new on this evening. And just a little reminder that there were 3,158 people screened for eligibility for this trial, and 2,260 of those were excluded. I can only imagine applying to try and have some help with your chronic fatigue when I think back to when I was bedbound, and if there'd have been something that I could have gone on, and the hope that you have in your heart when you know, see that there's something there that might help, and to then be told that you can't actually take part must have been so really devastating for these patients. And you know, it really sort of tugged my heartstrings when I read that, really. So there were a remaining 641 that were allocated to those four groups. And this was a slide we showed last night. Many of you will remember this. And this is the pretty much the trajectory of what happens when people go to their GP for help. You know, they go through all the sort of blood testing, which is often shows absolutely no problem, even though they're feeling really horrendous. They then start being referred out to different departments, different consultants, rheumatology, neurology. Sometimes they're referred to something called an expert patients program. And the problem with the expert patients program is that you are seated next to people that have things like spinal injuries, that have had life-changing injuries, and you know, sort of very long-term chronic conditions. So the message is loud and clear that you are not expected to recover, which was horrendously disappointing for me, and I actually didn't complete the program when I was referred to that. For me, I was looking for recovery, as are the clients that find the Chrysalis effect. You know, that's not what they want to do. They don't want to manage symptoms. Other things on offer through the NHS currently are graded exercise therapy and CBT, and these have formed the core element of the PACE trial. What the trial was about was to compare the effects of those four different groups. Some of them just had specialized medical care, which is basically advice, drug therapy, antidepressants, sleeping pills and painkillers, which is pretty much, you know, what I was offered when I was ill and didn't want them. So that alone, or the other three groups were the adaptive pacing therapy, cognitive behavioural therapy, or graded exercise therapy. So these were the things that were looked at. So some people just had specialist medical care, so they just had the advice, and others had that alongside the adaptive pacing therapy, or cognitive behavioural therapy, or graded exercise therapy. So they were looking to see what had the most impact. Now, you know, we ended up there with sent home, which is often the way for people when they've gone through all of these things, and perhaps, you know, some of it has a little bit of an effect, some of it doesn't have any effect, some people just are in the wrong place to be able to accept those therapies. And that's a big part of it, the Chrysalis effect, that we know is so important to know where people are at in their recovery process. So what I was really heartened with, and I mentioned this last night, was the fact that Professor Michael Sharp really does sort of seem to be speaking in alignment with the way we look at the CRIS effect, because we're very much looking at this being a recoverable condition. We have so many people, including myself, members of our team, and over the years, over 7 years of helping people now, we've had so many people go through to complete wellness that, you know, to see this as a long-term chronic condition that you're stuck with has to change. That whole mindset has to change. So the fact that he says it's wrong to say that people don't want to get better, but they get locked into a pattern and their life constricts around what they do. You know, he absolutely clearly believes in a much more positive outcome for sufferers. So in order to understand what he was trying to do, we need to have a look at what was available before the graded exercise therapy and the cognitive behavioural therapy. So we need to have a little look at this adaptive pacing therapy. Now, the perspective that it comes from is that the illness is seen as a non-reversible organic disease where sufferers have a reduced and finite amount of energy. And this therapy works to help them live within what is termed an envelope of activity. So basically, their life has to be cut down. They have to identify where their envelopes of activity lie and work within that, which is so restrictive. And if you know, what it hasn't taken into account is that, you know, this is absolutely something that people can completely recover from. And again, what it definitely hasn't looked at is the type of people that develop these conditions. So I want to go into a little bit of that tonight before I introduce Margaret. So at the CRISIS Effect, we teach recoverers and practitioners about the predispositions and elements of the ME profile. Now, so far, we've looked at some of the elements around the PACE trial, and there's absolutely no mention of a vital aspect that we find essential to help people with their recovery, is that people that succumb to a fatigue-related condition tend to share specific traits, if you like, or characteristics that predispose them to coming down with a chronic fatigue type condition. Now, there are five of those in the main, but tonight the areas that I want to concentrate on specifically are the A-type personality. Now, for those of you that are listening in tonight, maybe you could type some words in the question box if you've come across the term A-type personality. One of those words is definitely an overachiever that seems to link in with it. So we are looking, maybe you would like to type in some words, but some of the words that come to mind when we think about the A-types is quite driven, quite a perfectionist, like to be in control. They are people that are used to running, you know, a lot of things at the same time. They'll often have, you know, not just one job on the go, but several. They'll be, you know, the sort of social person in the group. You know, certainly when I was ill, you know, before I got ill, ours was the party house. You know, everybody gathered there, you know, the shoulder to cry on. It was definitely somebody that organized things and, you know, lived life really to a massive to-do list and sort of really had lots and lots of plates spinning. Now, it was only when I started researching recovery, because that's what I did before we went and went into the CRISIS Effect, started to look at what it took to recover. You know, not just looking at the illness, which unfortunately is kind of what happens with the medical profession. They tend to look at and study illness. We looked at what had people done to fully recover. And over again with every single person that we interviewed and every health profile that I've seen since, this trait shows up over and over again. And every practitioner that we train and that we stay in touch with and we talk about case studies, it is just there jumping off the page that people fit into this type of personality profile. If someone doesn't see themselves as somebody that's really pushing themselves quite hard in work and tend to overwork, or in sport, we see it and people that really push their bodies very hard will often love extreme sports and often do something like a 60-hour week at work and then go straight to the gym and not to do yoga, usually to do something like circuit training. If they don't see themselves as part of that personality, then they will certainly see themselves or will discover about themselves that they probably put themselves at the bottom of the list and being all things to all people and being a complete overgiver. So perhaps I can see a show of hands. How many of you are currently seeing clients at the moment with sort of fatigue type conditions? Maybe be great if you could just pop your hands up if you are already sort of seeing people that are presenting with fatigue, tired all the time, you know, some of the symptoms we talked about last night, headaches, migraines, gut issues, you know, starting to feel quite stressed, maybe not able to have the same sort of cognitive issue, perhaps they're starting to struggle with brain fog, those types of things. When you question them a little further, you know, how many of you recognize this personality type showing up in that type of person? Certainly when they're in phase one, you will see them still trying to maintain this high level of activity. The second element that is relevant to tonight's webinar is that they have a hugely high expectation of self, and this is set up very, very early on. Usually circumstances or family situations have meant that they have potentially as a young person taken on a lot of responsibility and always been that person that becomes kind of like the fixer in the family. And that pattern is imprinted quite early on, and this tends to set up the profile, a very important part of the profile that leads to pushing themselves extremely hard and pushing through. So that's just a couple of the predispositions. As I say, there are more, but they're the sort of most important ones for us to look at tonight. So now the difficulty with this, and there are other contributory factors, again, which we have to take into account. We're not going to look at those tonight. But what I want to share with you before we go into Margaret's presentation this evening on graded exercise therapy is the fact that being a high achiever, being somebody that pushes themselves, being somebody that gets a lot done, the trouble is there's another side to the profile that sets people up on a trajectory where they can end up with a fatigue type condition. So I just want to run through those with you tonight, and we call it the double bind of the ME profile. So what you will see with these type of clients, when they start to explain their lifestyle and the way they live and what they've done before they got ill, they will on the surface have always looked as if they're extremely independent, can literally cope with anything. They tend to display huge emotional strength. So they will be the people in the family that when there's a bereavement or when there's something happens, they will be the people that step up to the plate and really do deal with everything and, you know, be that sort of tower of strength, if you like. They look on the surface as if they reach their goals really easily. They're the type of people that you look at and say, my goodness, I just don't know how they fit it all in. I just don't know how they do it. They're amazing. You know, my nickname before I got ill was Wonder Woman Wilkins. So, you know, there you are. It's that type of thing. So hugely determined, always there for everyone. They're the shoulder to cry on. Usually it's, you know, if anyone's got a problem, they'll come to this person. And they look seemingly as if they have really great bounce back ability. And, you know, in control of their life. They're sort of, they are people that tend to have loads of projects on the go and are just amazing. Highly reliable and fit everything in with ease. That is what they would like you to see. And that is what you will see with these people. And through that, they will be normally excelling in whatever field that they enter. Now, there are underlying factors here that drive those behaviours, and this is what you don't see. This is the below the surface stuff that is really going on that is causing this double bind. Where on the surface, they look like they've got it all sorted and everything's fine, but underneath, what is really going on is often that because they have high levels of sensitivity, they create a very busy life to avoid feeling any sort of emotional pain. They are usually overly empathic and highly sensitive. They fit into the sort of 20% of the population. And we explain a lot about that to our clients, and they completely resonate. So that's a very important part of the teaching and the mentoring that we do. They feel everything extremely deeply, actually. So They don't like to show that, but they really do. So they can be very easily wounded. Children, when children are growing up and they have this high level of sensitivity, they won't deal very well with things like teasing and that type of thing. And a lot of this will set up, this is where the problems start to set up when they are children. They can't cope at all with conflict. They feel very overwhelmed in certain environments. And also, they tend to suffer in silence. They have become very independent and seem to feel that they have to fix everything themselves. They're also struggling with huge self-criticism, usually. That's where all this perfectionism comes from, and this feeling that they have to prove their worth and be the best at everything, that, be absolutely perfection in everything they do. Now, the worst thing for them is to think of as being seen as lazy or weak. So you can imagine if somebody who feels like this is struck down with a fatigue condition where they physically can't do something, and a condition that has tremendous stigma attached to it as well, you can see what a horrendous impact that would have on someone's emotional and psychological well-being. So in an effort to not appear lazy or weak when these health issues start to arise, they will do absolutely everything to avoid letting anyone see. So these conditions can be hidden for a very long time before people have a final tipping point that tips them over into becoming, literally not being able to cope with their life anymore. What happens in this negation of who they really are, this sort of inauthentic living, if you like, is that they lose their connection to their own body and live very much in their head. And all of this means that they tend to push themselves way beyond their limits. Now, in order for people to recover, they have to have and gain an awareness of this double bind. And that isn't done overnight. And the one thing that enables people to change their belief systems and their behaviors that would drive these conditions is coaching. So that is why the recovery program that developed back in 2009, it was a step-by-step, and it is a step-by-step recovery coaching program, because coaching shines a light on underlying behaviors and belief systems that create very unhelpful, behaviors and lifestyle that a lot of these people will have been living in order to try and sort of, keep everything, keep all those plates spinning. So there are underlying beliefs that ultimately will create the behaviors that have contributed to their breakdown in health. This is just a snapshot of the recovery program. It's a 24/7 supported program. There's a members area there. You can see they have fantastic recovery webinars in there, and they have a program that takes them through all those eight elements that we know that we look at for recovery. And they get weekly support in the forms of audios, videos. They get recovery stories. They get experts in that program, so that they are fully supported 24/7. So they are suffering from insomnia, they can go on that program in the middle of the night if they want, and there will be inspiration, education available for them. No matter how ill they are, they can access this from a computer, and no matter where they are in the world. So that's was the that's our sort of basic fundamental recovery coaching program. And our practitioners train to be able to integrate their own therapies to work around the recovery program and be able to use coaching skills with these clients. So I just wanted to give you a little bit of information around that to show that week by week they start to shine a light on things like their behavior systems, what they're eating, all of the elements that we know it's essential to look at for recovery. And we'll look at the wheel in a little while. So those of you that maybe didn't see that last night will get to see it this evening. Here it is. So we know that as part of that research, we needed to ensure that these eight areas are addressed for recovery. Those eight areas we looked last night, and we addressed nutritional health and thyroid and adrenals. This evening, we are going to be addressing the movement side of things with our guest expert. And in some to some great part as well, lifestyle and pace. So there are another two areas that we're going to be addressing tonight through the graded exercise therapy. Is graded exercise therapy really the answer? And understanding the sort of pathophysiology of pain and weakness in ME. So we need to look at that. The other elements that are on here, life purpose, emotional health, environment and relationships, will come very much into our third webinar, which looks at the sort of even deeper levels of emotional well-being, because all of those elements that we haven't covered off yet fit very much are very much a huge part of someone's emotional well-being and ultimate return to health. So just wanted to sort of remind you of that. So we ticked off nutritional health and thyroid and adrenals, and so now we're going to look at sort of movement and lifestyle and pace. So it's my great pleasure now to introduce you to our guest expert this evening. I'm just going to find her on here so that I can unmute her in a moment. So Margaret is a gold medal graduate of the British School of Osteopathy. She won the prize for anatomy, the prize for physiology. She won the prize for principles of osteopathy, and the prize for osteopathic technique, and the prize for osteopathic practice. She's has held posts there as a clinical lecturer, and it's absolutely no wonder that she holds the post of vice patron today. Her insight and passion for an integrated approach has led her to incorporate many other modalities and therapies, too many for me to mention, within her practice. She gained a distinction when taking her nutritional therapy diploma from Rolworth College for Sports Therapy and Natural Medicine, where she also qualified in sports nutrition and dietary therapy. Her consultancy, lecturing, and advisory roles have taken her across the globe to achieve an enviable reputation for lifelong work with dancers and performers, a selection of which include London School of Contemporary Dance, London Festival Ballet, English National Ballet and School, Royal Ballet School Teachers Training Course, Royal Danish Ballet and School, and the Peter Schulfus Ballet and School, Denmark. Alongside these, she's had long-standing associations with musical theatre, colleges and West End theatre productions. Consequently, she's in great demand for consultations and lectures on aspects of performance medicine. So as you can imagine, this has given Margaret unparalleled experience with the specific physical, dietary and emotional problems associated with all of these professions. She's been on TV. She has published articles in many prestigious magazines and journals, and we're delighted that she's chosen to join the Chrysalis Effect quite recently. She's joined our Chrysalis Effect practitioner community as a referral practitioner. So this is a fabulous profile, I'm sure you'll agree, for a fabulous lady. So let me open up the lines now and welcome Margaret Papoutsis. So Margaret, are you there?
I'm here. Can you hear me?
Wonderful. Yes. Probably if you can just speak up a little right. More, that would be wonderful. Welcome tonight. Thank you so much for coming along. I've read that and I'm just busting my buttons to hear you tonight. So it's been absolute joy working with you so far. I know that you've not been part of the Chrysalis Effect for very long, but we're delighted to have you, and I'm going to hand over to you now because I know that you've got some really fantastic information to share with everyone.
Okay, well, good evening everyone. Thank you for listening in tonight. First, I'd like to thank Ruth for all the wonderful information that she gave us yesterday. And as you've heard today, I've been asked by Elaine to talk a little bit about my previous experiences of exhaustive conditions and then focus on some of the musculoskeletal aspects of ME, chronic fatigue, and fibromyalgia. I'll attempt to relate them to the likely pathophysiology in these conditions and also consider the Chrysalis Effect approach to recovery. For those of you unfamiliar with Chrysalis Effect, we use a system which describes the different phases of the road to recovery from ME. These phases start with the initial denial phase, when there is a level of collapse and recovery which doesn't entirely put the individual out of action for extended periods. There are a variety of coping strategies attempted, but the struggle to maintain the destructive lifestyle gradually becomes a losing battle. The phase two, or crash phase, is the final result of this previous phase when there is complete burnout. Phase three represents the time when the sufferer is hanging on, learning to cope, but waiting for the magic bullet to cure them. In phase four, there's finally an acceptance that there must be some personal responsibility taken for the state of health, and progress can then be made towards recovery. Phase five is the learning and relapsing phase, where recoverers learn how to pace themselves and make the necessary lifestyle changes to enable a healthy future. The final phase six represents full recovery, a year without relapses and an understanding of how to stay well for the rest of their life. So now onto my own personal journey towards the chrysalis effect. Just a little water, sorry. As Elaine has indicated, I've spent my entire professional life surrounded by high-achieving type A individuals. Performers often appear to have a shy and retiring side to them, but in order to be successful, they actually need iron willpower, an ability to work unceasingly for extended periods of time, and a talent for completely ignoring the requirements of their body. Most performers suffer from regular periods of prolonged adrenal stress, and they spend much of their life moving in and out of a state which we in the chrysalis effect recognize as phase one denial. But then, of course, they are living their life purpose on a 24/7 basis, and this can give them enormous reserves to call upon. This is in direct contrast to so many people in the more normal world, who may dread every working day and subsequently be more likely to fall into subconscious avoidance behaviors or even crash completely. Performers of all types are enthusiastically into self-medication, as the tabloid press is always delighted to tell us. Alcohol's often the chosen medicine of actors and musicians, as the effects on voice and ability may not be so obvious in the short term. Dancers, on the other hand, tend to prefer smoking, as they believe it will curb their appetite, and they are not so concerned about their vocal cords. Recreational drugs are less common, except perhaps in the pop music industry. However, as the adrenal system becomes really depleted, the exhausted body is no longer supplied with that adrenal high, which of course is an essential requirement for sustained performance. At this point, cocaine may become more attractive, particularly amongst the older actor or dancer who lives in fear of losing their edge. It is these people who are the most likely to fall off the tightrope into crash phase two and spend some significant length of time in the priory. Number four, please. Yes, break. Of course, the public relations office is unlikely to explain the sudden absence of a celebrity as chronic fatigue. It will probably be described as taking a break to spend more time with their family, or perhaps suffering from exhaustion after the latest film. One particular patient of mine was a highly respected performer who had starred in a long string of successful shows. He was contracted to take the lead in a production which did not live up to the original and much advertised promise. Although he had great reviews personally, it was very obvious that he was the sole reason that the show had not failed completely. He felt huge pressure to maintain the enormously high-energy role that he played. The entire future of the company, cast and crew, seemed to fall on his shoulders alone. Gradually, he started to come into the theater earlier, stay later, exercise compulsively, and eat less. Every day was mental and emotional turmoil, and he confided to me that he felt that his career might be blighted forever. Not surprisingly, he went into meltdown just a few days after the show came off. Fortunately, he did recover both his health and his professional reputation, as he was able to take 6 months off work and get away from the pressures of the theatrical world. It is probably due to this enforced resting, as they euphemistically call it, that more performers do not actually crash. Surprisingly, ME is not that common amongst dancers, despite their obsessive exercise. The type of situation which might precipitate a crash in actors or singers will be more likely to manifest as disordered eating in dancers. For example, young dancers who have just embarked upon professional training can suddenly realize that they are perhaps not as talented as they had imagined. Having been a big fish in the small pond of local dance schools, it can be devastating to find themselves in a vast ocean of more talented people. How could they bring themselves to tell their doting parents that it's all a mistake, when the training is probably being financed by a new mortgage on the family home? A subconscious avoidance strategy can provoke an eating disorder rather than ME. The panic-stricken parents will be so terrified for their child's health that they no longer worry about the mortgage. It can be an elegant, though usually subconscious, route out of a seemingly impossible situation. Next one, please. Learning about the chrysalis effect and its approach to chronic exhaustive disorders has been a revelation for me. It's brought into sharp focus many years of treating patients with ME, but never feeling I could really treat them for their problem. I could obtain good symptomatic relief in many cases, but the continual relapses made it obvious that something really important was missing. What I lacked, of course, was the whole understanding that the chrysalis effect provides. In retrospect, I've been able to categorize previous patients into their respective phases and understand how differently I might have approached them now. How wonderful it would have been to then have had access to practitioners with their own specialist areas, to have the opportunity to be part of a team who could approach this frustrating disorder holistically and with a remarkable level of recovery. So, now, as promised, I'm going to be talking about some of the musculoskeletal aspects of chronic exhaustive conditions. For simplicity, I will use ME as a generic term to cover all variations, although fibromyalgia will be singled out occasionally. Incidentally, I see that in the US, every variation may soon be labeled systemic exertion intolerance disease, which is quite a mouthful, but I think it's fairly descriptive. Just having a little sip of water. I will touch on the possible pathophysiology of ME and how this impacts on the approach to activity, exercise, and bodywork in the different phases of recovery. I am using bodywork as a blanket description of all types of manual and physical therapy and will give examples as we progress. However, examples are not meant to be interpreted as exclusive. Same applies to suggested therapies. There just isn't time to include all the possibilities. So I hope I don't offend anyone by leaving out their own particular area of expertise. As you might be aware, the chrysalis effect approach to recovery is significantly wider in scope than the NICE recommendations. Professor Sharp came to the conclusion that a combination of graded exercise alongside CBT could help ME sufferers increase their energy and stamina. Well, this is a step in the right direction, but constitutes an approach which we would regard as far from holistic. We must be happy that at least there is now more recognition of ME as a genuinely existing condition. But there are still too many gaps to be filled. Next one, please. Briefly, here is a representation of graded exercise therapy, or GET, as it is designed to work in theory. The physiotherapist and patient come together to set goals and negotiate an acceptable and appropriate exercise regime. This is then implemented and adjusted by the physiotherapist with input from the patient, resulting in improved energy. This sounds fairly reasonable, doesn't it? But a retrospective survey was carried out by the ME Association involving ME sufferers who had actually taken part in graded exercise therapy. This found that 33 to 50% reported that they actually became significantly worse, and many felt that they had been pressurized into more exercise than they were able to cope with. Many of these individuals withdrew from the program. So it would appear that although a significant number improved, GET is perhaps not really suitable as a therapy for absolutely everyone. But why not? And is the pacing recommended by the ME Association actually more helpful and realistic? At the Chrysalis Effect, we recognize that there are different phases of recovery and acknowledge that ME is a multifactorial problem. So how could any one approach be suitable for everyone? We also understand that the most common personality type found in the disorder is type A, people who are the least likely to be able to pace themselves anyway, one of the very reasons they end up suffering from ME in the first place. Different people need different approaches, and different phases need different activities and therapies. Number seven, please. So, shall we first consider some of the possible pathophysiology involved in the fatigue and pain in ME and fibromyalgia? I won't go into this in too much detail, as I know that the other webinars are also considering this area. However, I will try to illustrate the complexity of the problem. This chart is obviously not all-encompassing, but will serve as a good reference to help explain the varying requirements of the different phases. Drawing on our familiarity with issues of adrenal exhaustion and the domino effect it has on the body, we can see that any consideration of exercise or physical treatment needs to keep in mind that there will inevitably be problems of cellular energy production. An unbalanced sympathetic biased autonomic system will raise overall energy requirements anyway and stress the adrenals. Anxiety loops lead to yet more dysfunction via the HPA axis. Panic attacks and hyperventilation further reduce the supply of available oxygen for aerobic energy production. Nutritional deficiencies and reduced detoxification capacity can result in mitochondrial dysfunction, DNA damage, and increased neural sensitivity. The capacity for aerobic metabolism is quickly exhausted in ME, and anaerobic energy production is forced to take over. And this, as we know, is very inefficient, producing only a fraction of the ATP that the Krebs cycle can make. The consequent accumulation of lactic acid further interferes with ATP recycling and increases AMP loss. This leads to a situation where ATP needs to be continuously renewed from basics, and that can take several days, even assuming that the raw materials are available. It's no wonder that ME involves weakness, fatigue, and slow recovery. Pain and tenderness in the musculoskeletal system is particularly marked in fibromyalgia, and several mechanisms for this have been suggested. There is, of course, likely to be cellular inflammation. This might result in part from increased lactic acid, impaired antioxidant capacity, and nutritional deficiencies. But reduced circulation of both blood and lymph will slow down the clearance of lactic acid and other potential toxins. This is in turn aggravated by the inability of the ME patient to take part in any significant exercise. Next one, please. But of course, it's not only energy production for activity which is impaired. There's also the problem that this whole scenario engenders a predisposition to both damage and slow repair, a lose-lose situation to which can also be added the low melatonin levels resulting from disturbed or inadequate sleep. And what about systemic acidosis, which has such widespread negative effects? This is probably only the tip of the iceberg, but it does show that we need to keep in mind three main areas when we consider whether graded exercise therapy is going to be precisely what the client needs. Number nine, please. The considerations are, firstly, reduced availability of aerobic energy. Secondly, increased predisposition to damage. And thirdly, decreased repair capacity, resulting in slow recovery. Above all, we need to take note of the phase of recovery that the client is exhibiting. Exercise in ME recovery is essential, but to be both safe and effective, it should preferably be supervised by a therapist who really understands both the physiology and the psychology of their client. Such a person can put exercise firmly within a holistic approach. Who better then than a chrysalis effect trained therapist? So we continue now and look at the previously mentioned phases of recovery and consider them in the context of everything we've been talking about. Phase one, denial. Next one, please. That's great. This is the phase which I personally have the most experience. Frequently, these people are already over-exercising and they tend to be very resistant to a reduction in their activities. Sometimes it's easier at first to encourage them to switch to something less energetic rather than suggest that they should cut down drastically. Keeping sessions shorter and interspersing them with relaxing or meditative pursuits will allow time for them to recover adequately. As we know, phase one recoverers are really bad at pacing themselves or listening to their bodies, so it's safer for them to exercise under supervision whenever possible. Understanding why their energy capacity is compromised can help them to realize that exercise can be their enemy as well as their friend at this point. It all depends on balance, and this, of course, is a concept that they really aren't conversant with. So, what type of exercise is best for these particular people? Well, it is advisable to avoid anything aerobic, as they're already pushing the boundaries of oxygen usage and will quickly move into anaerobic mood. This is particularly dangerous for cardiac muscle. Sudden, unexplained heart attacks are known to occur in young, apparently fit and healthy individuals. Is it possible that this catastrophe may be predisposed by unrecognized phase one adrenal depletion? Keep in mind recent opinions that have been put forward on the cause of heart attacks as opposed to heart disease. These ideas suggest that in cardiac muscle, a sudden sympathetic overload can occur during exercise. If significant parasympathetic depletion coexists, the myocardium is unable to react appropriately and severe local cellular damage occurs. It is thought that the local infarction may actually be the result of this neuromuscular explosion, as it was described. This would suggest that sympathetically challenged phase one clients might be the very people at greatest risk of this. So be careful. You don't want that happening on your watch. It is vital that this type of client understands exactly why they can't exercise their way out of fatigue. Type A's need to be thoroughly convinced at this stage, otherwise they will not comply and may suddenly crash into phase two. Exercise such as Pilates, Tai Chi, or gentle yoga, not hot yoga though, will maintain flexibility and control and improve posture. This is important as good posture will allow the recoverer to look better and permit lungs and viscera to function more efficiently. As already mentioned, it's also helpful to encourage them to do something relaxing, which will give their parasympathetic system a boost. Body work also needs to find an acceptable balance. Our type A client is likely to respond best to a therapy with a definite feel-good factor, although it needs to avoid being too invasive. Massage, Bowen technique, shiatsu, they're all popular. Conversely, a long, strong massage may feel great immediately, but might put them out of action for days afterwards. Osteopathically, I often find good results from gentle manipulation accompanied by only minimal soft tissue work. Just a few extra points regarding fibromyalgia. Some recoverers with this presentation can benefit from treatments which encourage circulation and lymphatic drainage. However, this will always depend on the level of sensitivity. Lymphatic drainage techniques are ideal, and cupping, Bowen therapy, and hot stones can give significant, if sometimes only temporary, relief. Once again, it's essential to judge and adjust any therapy on every occasion, as reactions will never be predictable. A really bad reaction may lose you the client forever, so start minimally and explain continuously. There has been a recent discovery of a previously undetected lymphatic drainage channel in the brain, which appears to drain into the neck. This may explain why craniosacral therapy and manipulation of the neck frequently produce almost instant positive reactions in ME and fibromyalgia patients. Another interesting piece of research indicates that those suffering from fibromyalgia appear to have unusually numerous and hypersensitive nerve endings in the blood vessels in the palms of their hands. It is hypothesized that this may impact negatively on the autonomic nervous system as a whole, and pain sensitivity in particular. Interestingly, I have come across fibromyalgia sufferers who have experienced significant improvement following attunement into Reiki. Perhaps these two things are related. I'm of the opinion that the presentation of fibromyalgia has much in common with the musculoskeletal side effects of statin medication. This problem is thought to be related to a reduced production of coenzyme Q10 in the liver and the subsequent effects on mitochondrial function in the muscles. CoQ10 production itself requires significant use of energy, and we are aware that liver function is often impaired in fibromyalgia and ME patients. There may well be a correlation here, and we should keep this in mind when considering the cardiac effects of aerobic exercise. Next one, please. Those in crash phase will rarely have any inclination towards exercise and need to be approached with great care, sensitivity, and patience. They're often in great discomfort, which can be easily aggravated by movement. At this stage, it's difficult to maintain any significant degree of muscle strength. So flexibility and circulation are more important areas, probably. Gentle passive and assisted movements of the limbs can be accomplished with a little help from a carer. Any activities which are within the patient's ability should, of course, be encouraged too. In phase two, it's likely to be the more relaxing therapies which are more appropriate. Reiki, healing, meditation, acupuncture, craniosacral therapy, all possibilities. Many sufferers can benefit from the various breathing techniques at this time. If weather permits, sitting or walking barefoot on the grass can be very relaxing and refreshing. Some people respond to very short, very gentle massage or shiatsu. but will often experience delayed fatigue, so go gently. Aromatherapy can be too strong a detox for the depleted liver in this phase, so using unscented oils may be a safer option. Whether it's exercise or body work, phase two is likely to be the most difficult phase to handle and predict. Many times you may have to delay almost any intervention until the nutritional and psychological aspects begin to show an improvement. Next one, please. Phase three, the external search. This can be a frustrating time. The outward-looking heal me state of mind can be a definite obstacle to improved physical function. These people may be convinced that any exercise will result in permanent harm. Theoretically, graded exercise should be a useful approach, but there is frequently great resistance to even the gentlest of regimes. I suspect that many of the dropouts from the GET research may have been in this phase. Assuming that you do actually get a chance to offer some help, it's likely you will be expected to provide only symptomatic treatment rather than initiate an actual exercise program. As we know, in this phase, the mindset tends to be about learning to cope and waiting for a cure. So it can be an uphill battle to produce a more optimistic and holistic outlook. You may need to wait for your other chrysalis effect colleagues to do their magic first. Especially in fibromyalgia, the physical therapist may be the first port of call, and this can present a really good opportunity to open a conversation concerning recovery and the chrysalis effect. As in phase two, the non-invasive therapies and activities may be seen as less threatening and more acceptable. In theory, it should be possible to encourage gradually increasing exertion, but this is the phase of secondary gain and identification with the disorder, and we must never underestimate the power of this mindset. One of my patients was diagnosed with Royal Free disease, as ME was originally called, over 40 years ago. She spent the ensuing years until her death last year in phases 2 and 3, waiting for the cure that never came. As far as exercise is concerned, many of the same caveats apply here as in phase 2. If you can manage to establish some degree of trust, then there might be a possibility that you can encourage gentle movement and stretching to begin with. However, once it's realized that a degree of post-activity fatigue is not life-threatening, the sufferer finally becomes a recoverer, and the chrysalis effect can be their road to phase four. Next one, please. Clinically, this can be the most rewarding phase to work with. As just mentioned, the sufferer is becoming a recoverer and is open to the idea of progress. Other segments of the recovery wheel are being addressed, and there is just a little light at the end of the tunnel. This is the phase which becomes more suitable for graded exercise therapy. Hopefully, the cellular metabolism is beginning to normalize, and thyroid and adrenal issues are improving. As ATP production and recycling become slowly more adequate, recoverers can safely be encouraged to slowly increase their energy output. Personally, I've often found a more positive reaction to increased activity, as there is initially still a great deal of fear surrounding the concept of exercise. Clear and simple explanations of the changing levels of energy production are essential and can avert a lot of anxiety. Phase four recoverers need to build confidence in their ability to renew their energy rather than living in continuous dread of falling back into crash phase again. It's vitally important that these phase four recoverers have access to the support and encouragement that they need. Probably for the very first time in their lives, they are learning to pace themselves, and this could be quite traumatic for them. Therapeutic requirements will vary tremendously on a daily basis, depending on the energy available. So it's helpful to have an armory of different therapies which can be mixed and matched as required. On a good day, a stronger massage might be tolerated. Conversely, some days may need Reiki or reflexology. Only your experience with that particular individual will tell you. However, now is the time to begin to educate the client in the art of listening to their body. An ongoing process for all of us, I suspect. Phase five, please. Recovery and relapse. Phase five is both exciting and frustrating for everyone involved. Delighted to make full use of their newfound energies, recoverers can easily get carried away and provoke relapses. Maintenance of physical improvement relies greatly on learning to pace themselves. As we said, probably the hardest concept for any type A personality to take on board. It is essential to listen honestly to the body and not to revert to the old habits of, I can do it, because maybe I can today, but then not necessarily tomorrow. In phase five, I tend to feel that graded exercise is also graded danger. It is safer to encourage controlled exercise like Pilates, yoga, or Tai Chi, and gradually increase the frequency before addressing intensity. Old habits die hard, and anything with a competitive edge is definitely off the menu in the earlier stages. The aerobic side of exercise can be safely approached using activities such as swimming, walking, and maybe cycling. By this time, the exercise supervisor should be able to recognize the dangerous areas for each individual and carefully tailor the program to promote progress without unnecessary fatigue. As the times between relapses elongate and recovery periods become shorter, recoverers can be left with more self-regulation. Hopefully, they now understand the behaviors and lifestyle which produced their problem in the first place. The graded exercise approach is still relevant, though, but begins to take on a different function. Building strength, stamina, and flexibility is paramount to the phase five recoverer, who can see the possibility of an active life again. These goals are attained more quickly and safely by encouraging the more challenging versions of Pilates, yoga, and the gentler martial arts. The spinning class or the gym are very dangerous places for Taipeis. It's also really important to maintain the parasympathetic nurturing habits, as these can often be jettisoned once phase five approaches phase six. This gradual but unnoticed move towards mainly adrenaline-fueled exercise can be very subtle, but it is probably responsible for many a long phase five, so keep up the meditation. Therapeutically, there may be increased need for injury treatment at this point, of course, and stronger, more definite massage may be both tolerated and actually enjoyed. Dopamine is back on the scene for these people. Phase six. Full recovery. When full recovery is attained, graded exercise can still be useful and relevant. For many, recovery means the ability to become fitter and stronger than they've ever been. Having developed the habit of body awareness and safe, conscious exercise in the previous phases, this approach continues to allow increasing performance without increased injuries and stress. Interestingly, full recoverers often comment that they are in their best condition ever, yet are doing less exercise and enjoying it more. Thanks to the chrysalis effect, the lessons of phase one have finally been learned. Thank you very much.
Margaret, thank you so much for that. I've been chuckling away here about the some of the things you've been saying about the A types, thinking, oh my God, that was so mean.
And me.
And you, I know, we've had that discussion. So I just, if people have got any questions for Margaret, do type them in. But I think that was just a phenomenal presentation. So I'd welcome any input in that question box if you'd like to type in anything you'd like me to pass on to Margaret. So thank you so much, Margaret, for taking time to put all of that together. I've learned so much tonight and some really fascinating information there from, you know, the sort of musculoskeletal side, and it's just been really fantastic to learn so much. So thank you. And we have your references here, which we will put in the email that goes out, so that we can make sure people want to sort of look up anything that you've mentioned that they can. So thank you so much for supplying that as well. So I'm just going to, so a huge thank you to you. And just, I know that we're slightly over time, so just to remind those of you that are joining us again tomorrow, we have webinar 3, which is with our crisis effect specialist practitioner, Patricia Warby, and she is going to be covering stress, trauma and unresolved emotion and its effect on mitochondrial function. But first and foremost, because of her background in as a research scientist, she's going to be critiquing the current research on the PACE trial. So I'm really looking forward to that, because I've had really interesting conversation with Patricia about what she has found out about these types of trials that are performed. And I think you're going to be fascinated to know how they're funded and what goes on around them, and also her findings. So she's going to start the evening with that, and then she's going to go into some really in-depth information around how the emotions cause disease, unconscious brain, implicit traumatic memory, stress response, mind-body connection, mitochondria, the evolutionary origins, which are fascinating, around DNA, and mitochondrial under stress, aerobic respiration, so much, and also some case studies. So her book is available, The Scar That Won't Heal. You can get that on Amazon, so you may want to start looking at that. I've read it, in fact I reviewed it as one of the reviewers, and it was just fascinating. So that's our wonderful guest joining us tomorrow, that will conclude our three-part webinar series. So it'd be lovely to be with you tomorrow again. And Patricia has a question. Margaret, she's on here tonight, saying, what's the link between blood vessels in the hand and heart and brain function? So can you answer that now, or do you want to email?
Yeah. Actually, you'll find it on the research there. They have found that a lot of people with fibromyalgia have an excessively large number of very small, oversensitive pain nerves on the shunts between the arterioles and the venous system in the hands. And they are thinking that maybe there are times when blood can get into the hands but actually can't get out. And because of this, it seems to trigger off some sort of overall reaction with the autonomic system, which makes pain and muscular pain in particular more sensitive. I think that's as far as they've got at the moment. I don't think they've look as though they've taken it any farther, but it's quite an interesting outlook, isn't it?
Fantastic, thank you so much. Patricia saying thank you very much. Also, we have a question here, how long can recovery take? It is a piece of, how long is a piece of string? It does depend on the phase that people are in when they, certainly when they arrive at the chrysalis effect, they can be in any one of those phases. Tends to be in phases 1, 2, or 3 usually, but so it does depend, and it depends on the changes that they're willing to make, but obviously initially how depleted their system is, because that's the first sort of port of call. What we will say is that By the time people are into about their 6 months, they are usually in a very, very different place. So the average time when people are left to their own devices and are highly motivated is usually about 6 years. So we're looking to get that and shortcut that for people. So we are looking more at sort of a year to 2 years. 9 months is feasible too. We've seen that, but it depends what they've already done by the time, you know, they start their sort of holistic step-by-step plan. Bapinda is also saying, is experiencing paresthesia in extremities a common complaint? And if so, how can patients help themselves?
That's for you and for me.
That's for you, Margaret, that one.
Okay. Yes, I think paresthesia is probably quite common. And if this situation with the arteriovenous shunts in the hands is something which we're going to have to take seriously, maybe there's a similar thing happening in the feet. Certainly people usually say that they get very cold feet, and often they get cold feet and then burning feet. So, you know, paresthesia can be caused by the nerves, it can be caused by the circulation, and I suspect quite often both in these sort of cases. So it depends what it's due to. I would suggest that it's worth trying hot and cold bathing, alternate bathing, because if it is a problem of circulation not getting out of the hands, for instance, then it might be that that would be something that would help the circulation. The other thing that might help is grounding. If you look that up, there's quite a lot of research on that too, and that was what I mentioned about walking on the lawn in bare feet. That does seem to help a lot of people who have paresthesia for some reason. I'm sure there is some research out there somewhere which tells us exactly why.
Very important, actually. We you know, definitely look at that with people, making sure they get out in nature as much as possible, and, you know, walking on the beach or getting out into sort of onto grass, as you said. So it's such an important part of recovery, is reconnecting and grounding oneself. So I'm very aware that we are at way over time now. So as I say, thank you so much, Margaret, for that. I've put Margaret's slide up there because I'm sure that if you want to drop her an email, she'd be more than happy to answer any individual questions regarding anything that she's shared with us this evening. But I think we've taken enough of your time, Margaret. So thank you so much. And we really look forward to being with you tomorrow night, Patricia. And I know that we've had such a lot of interest in this webinar series, and I think people are also waiting for this final part around the emotional recovery and the research critique. So we're looking forward to that. So thank you so much, everyone, for joining us. We look forward to being with you again, same time tomorrow. Thank you again, Margaret, and I shall see you soon. Bye, everyone.
Bye.